the strategic lessons of the Bernie Sanders campaign.
His campaign, that is, has exposed how undemocratic the U.S. electoral system is. I think that even while the kinds of things that he's encountering, the kinds of obstacles that he's encountering, are not new, they're being exposed in an unprecedented way. And people are, even longtime activists, who, including political or electoral activists, weren't even fully aware of the degree to which the system is so stacked and rigged against insurgent candidacies like his.
That's political scientist Patrick Barrett. We talk with him about his article, Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign. Then we re-air our 2008 interview with muckraking reporter Greg Palast about his book, Steal Back Your Vote. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Why do Americans vote at a lower rate than voters in any other advanced country? Maybe because that's the way our election system intends it. Voter suppression takes many forms, and it's institutionalized by both parties. In fact, that phrase, both parties, is a big part of the problem. In a two-party system, there's no real competition. That means the people's needs and choices are ignored. A recent report out from Princeton and Northwestern universities found that U.S. government policies rarely align with the preferences of the majority of Americans, but they do favor special interests and lobbying organizations. Majorities of Americans are in favor of strong action on climate change, lowering income inequality, single-payer health care, and increasing Social Security. But that's not what the two parties favor. And the one candidate in this primary season who does support those policies, Bernie Sanders, has faced enormous institutional roadblocks to his campaign. Some of those roadblocks appear to be actual election fraud, such as wholesale purges of likely Sanders voters and flipping of votes and voting machines from Sanders to Clinton. I was a poll worker in New York, Suffolk County on April 19th. At my polling station in a working-class district that favored Sanders, we had an unprecedented number of Democratic voters who had been purged from the rolls, more than 20%. More than 20% at my election district, and many of them were longtime Democratic voters who had not moved and had voted in every election. But it doesn't take fraud to suppress the vote. The majority of U.S. voters are independents with no party affiliation, yet in most states they have no choice of which candidates they will get to vote for in the general election. New York's closed primary is a case in point. It's no accident that Sanders, who has great support among independents, does well in open primaries, but falters where the party machine has total control. Suppression takes other forms, too, like voter ID and limiting early voting. Why aren't election days national holidays like they are in other countries? Why aren't all citizens automatically registered to vote when they attain voting age? Why do felons lose their right to vote, even after they've served their time? In Australia, not voting is a crime. In America, it's getting harder and harder to vote. My guest, political scientist Patrick Barrett, studies democratic political change and how it happens. His recent article, Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign, caught my attention after the fiasco of the New York primary. Barrett is director of the A.E. Haven Center for Social Justice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He writes and teaches about U.S. and Latin American politics and is the co-editor of the New Latin American Left. I called Barrett up to see what were the options we face if we want to have real democracy in our elections. Well, Patrick Barrett, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in this article, Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign, you write that Sanders has profoundly reconfigured the U.S. political landscape. How has he done that?
Well, I think there's two ways in which he's done that. One is that he's given further voice to what has been a building outrage, if you will, over the great inequality that's true of the United States. And, of course, that's been true for a long time now. The United States has always, of course, been inequitable, but it's been especially intensifying in the last 40 years and at an accelerating pace. And we've seen a number of different expressions of that, whether it's the Battle of Seattle in 99 or Nader's Green Party run in 2000 or the Wisconsin Uprising or the Occupy Wall Street movement. But he's given further voice to that through what's become an unexpectedly strong presidential run. So that's one way in which he's really sort of given voice to this great economic anxiety and insecurity that quite a few people feel, and this full-throated denunciation of class inequality and corporate power. But in another way, I think it may be even more significantly, his campaign, that is, has exposed how undemocratic the U.S. electoral system is. I think that even while the kinds of things that he's encountering, the kinds of obstacles that he's encountering, are not new, they're being exposed in an unprecedented way, and people are, even longtime activists, who, including political or electoral activists, weren't even fully aware of the degree to which the system is so stacked and rigged against insurgent candidacies like his. And so one of the great, I think, lessons, but also services that this campaign is providing is that it's exposing those limitations in a very significant way.
So what happens when a system is exposed in that way? You know, it's kind of like the emperor's new clothes. What is the impact? What happens to a system that can no longer pretend, where it's shown that it's actually rigging the system? What happens?
Well, that remains to be seen, doesn't it? I mean, I think that it's very hard to know now what will be the aftermath of this election and how historically significant it will end up being. I would predict that there are various channels or ways in which people will react to this, and they'll probably react in all of these ways. One way is that people will decide that there's nothing to be done, that they'll throw up their hands and get frustrated and disillusioned, and in fact join the ranks of what constitutes the majority of people in this country who do not get engaged politically, and who they sort of embody, as I say in the article, this attitude that Margaret Thatcher enunciated, that there is no alternative. So some people will get disillusioned in that way. Some people will lower their expectations and say, well, I've got to go back to the kind of lesser evil sort of mentality of accepting the limitations of somebody, let's say like Hillary Clinton and the like, and not do anything else other than that. Others might just sit on their hands and wait around for the next sort of insurgent, radical, or rebel candidate to come along, which who knows how long that might be. I fear that some people might end up being attracted to different types of insurgent candidates, like, say, a Donald Trump, who, in fact, has been very effective in tapping into working class discontent, much like Sanders has. But then there's a final category of people where I rest my hopes, and that's the people who will derive the right kind of lessons from this experience, realize the limitations of this system, and devote themselves to two things, one of which is that they will place a lot of their energy and effort into building militant, politically independent social movements. And to the degree that they get engaged in the electoral process, which I hope that they will do so with a mindset of radically democratizing it so that it's no longer a rigged system, and that takes into account the whole array of different institutional mechanisms that are designed to block change. So it's unknown, of course, how many people will fall into any one of those various categories. Those are the ones that I can envision the different directions that people could go in reaction to their frustrations. My hope is on that last category, that people will devote themselves to building militant, politically independent social movements and to democratizing not just the electoral system, but the whole political apparatus and set of state institutions and all the other institutions, whether it's schools or media or what have you, where we're at a disadvantage.
So let's go back for just a minute to how we got to where we are, Patrick Barrett. In your article, Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign, you go through the history of how we devolved a more democratic party. Tell us a little bit about how that happened. You talk about reforms that were instituted in the 1980s to block insurgent candidates like Sanders.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's important to point out that the Democratic Party has always been primarily a party of big business. I mean, that was true even during the New Deal. And so there have been moments in time like the New Deal and like the late 60s or the mid to late 60s when the Democratic Party oversaw the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson. In both of those instances, I think that the most important element that made those moments possible were the existence of mass movements, militant mass movements, in one case primarily the labor movement in the 30s, and in the latter case in the 60s, the civil rights movement. There's a couple of things that changed, especially beginning in the 1970s, which was the turning point, and the Democratic Party began to move to the right. On the one hand, there was an economic crisis of historical proportions, where the post-war era of economic prosperity was clearly coming to an end, and we entered into a severe economic crisis, especially in the 1970s. That changed the game, and it made it less possible for to accommodate various, interests of poor and working class people than it had been previously. And so, crucially, the reaction on the part of big business in the early 70s was to go on a significant and aggressive offensive, especially against labor, because their profits had been falling. And in order to raise profits in reaction to the crisis, they embarked on this offensive against organized labor. At the same time, the social movements, especially the civil rights movements of the 1960s, went into decline. So you had this very significant shift in the social balance of forces in the country at a moment of economic crisis. And this was illustrated in the Carter administration, which actually embarked on all the things that we associate with Reaganomics, whether it was deregulation or cuts in social spending, great increases in military spending, the appointment of Paul Volcker to the central bank, the Federal Reserve, that is, and the adoption of monetarism, all these things that we think of as Reaganomics, which Reagan took much further, of course, started under the Democrats when they had great majorities in both houses of Congress and controlled the presidency. But this was their reaction to the economic crisis, and it was something that reflected this shift in the balance of power in the country between, on the one hand, big business, and on the other, labor and social movements. And so by the 1980s, when Reagan was in office, many Democrats easily accommodated this this shift. And when Reagan pursued the Reaganomics even further, you saw also beginning in the 70s and accelerating during the 1980s, the birth of the modern era of campaign finance, where the amount of money that big business and lobbyists spent on influencing Congress and elected officials and candidates went through the roof. So by the 1980s, the shift in the Democratic Party was becoming even more evident, especially with the establishment of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was created by a group of Southern senators and governors who embarked on a strategy of distancing the party even further from the labor movement, from poor people, from black people, and tried to gain even more closer relations with the business community. And so the kinds of reforms that you see Hillary Clinton taking advantage of today, such as Super Tuesday or the superdelegates, those sorts of things, they were instituted in the 1980s, and they were specifically designed to sort of consolidate this move to the right and prevent the kind of insurgent candidates you saw in, say, the form of George McGovern in 72 or Jesse Jackson in the 1980s and now, of course, Bernie Sanders in 2016. And that strategy came to fruition in 1992 with the election of Bill Clinton and Al Gore, both of whom were leaders within the Democratic Leadership Council, both of them from the South, one governor and one senator, and who then embarked on a whole series of landmark initiatives of their own, whether it was, you know, the now famous 1994 crime bill or the end of welfare as we know it, NAFTA, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the Telecommunications Act, all of these things that really privileged business at the expense of everyone else and further shifted this balance of social forces in favor of big business at the expense of everyone else. And so just intensified this downward spiral of the Democratic Party moving to the right. And Hillary Clinton is the both the heir and the embodiment of this process.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm talking with political scientist Patrick Barrett about his recent article for Truthout, Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign. Now, we are doing this interview just a few days after the New York primary. I was a poll worker for the New York primary, and I, like the other poll workers around me, saw a vast number of people whose names had been purged from the voter rolls, something that we had never seen. This is only my second election, but everybody else who'd been there for much, much longer than I had never seen anything remotely like that. I've written about that online, but my question is this. If this was corruption, how does that enter into these reforms? In other words, I guess what I'm saying is, has the system become corrupt both in legal and illegal ways in a way that makes it impossible to operate on the electoral sphere?
So this is a multifaceted sort of problem. So part of it has to do, and maybe we should come back to this, the nature of a two-party system. But just addressing these sorts of phenomena that we see both in New York this time around or in other states where we've had either caucuses or primaries, there's a long history to this sort of behavior. There's actually, I would highly recommend a book by the title, actually it's come out in two editions, by Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. The second edition of the book was Why Americans Still Don't Vote, and the subtitle, Why Politicians Want It That Way. And it's a very dense and illuminating history on voter suppression in the United States and the design of institutions that are aimed to keep voter turnout low. Helps to explain, among other things, there are other reasons for this, why Americans vote at a lower rate than any other advanced industrialized country, and that's been true for a very, very long time, although it is also important to point out that voting turnout is falling everywhere, including in Europe. But just speaking of New York, for example, in 1984, during the Democratic primary season, when Al Gore was a candidate, so was Jesse Jackson. Ultimately, neither of them were the person who won the Democratic nomination. But one of the things that occurred during that primary process was that Jesse Jackson was doing surprisingly well. And Mario Cuomo at the time was governor, and he was on the verge of issuing an executive decree that would make it possible for black people and poor people who were more likely to frequent welfare offices and unemployment offices to be able to register to vote in those offices, making it far more likely that they'd get on the voter rolls. And the DNC persuaded, and the Mondale campaign persuaded the Cuomo administration not to issue that decree until after the primary for fear that it would give more strength to Jesse Jackson. And I mention Al Gore because the understanding is that he stayed in the election far after it was obvious that he was going nowhere in order to deny votes to Jesse Jackson. So this is just one example among many we could cite of the kinds of shenanigans and sort of power maneuvers that people engage in order to favor certain candidates over the others or block certain candidates, especially in the latter category, any that would represent a real sort of challenge to the machine that represents any political party, but especially one in a two-party system. And the reason that's relevant is that there's no competition other than a party to the right, which for people who want to move, say, the Democratic Party to the left, is not an option. Voting for the Republicans isn't an option for somebody who wants to move the Democrats to the left. The only thing that would make that possible would be the existence of a credible threat to the left of the Democrats. Credible because one could actually opt for this other party with no fear of wasting one's vote or spoiling the election and thereby electing the even worse alternative in the form of a Republican. So in the absence of that competitive option, a credible threat to go elsewhere, people have no influence both over the general policy direction of the Democratic Party or how it behaves in selecting its candidates. So to give you just an example, in Germany, the Greens instituted what they call a zipper list. In other words, so in a parliamentary system where you have multi-member districts, unlike the United States, you have a list of candidates, and whatever percentage of the vote you elect a certain number of candidates. So on their list, they had a zipper where it was alternating woman and man candidate. So no matter how many they elected, roughly 50% would be women. And this created a competitive pressure on the other parties to do something about their discriminatory attitudes towards women, so that even the Christian Democrats started instituting reforms in order to make it possible for more women to get elected. It's this sort of competitive pressure that makes it possible for parties to actually come under the kind of pressure that would make them more inclined to be more democratic, even internally, let alone what they do in terms of the policies that they offer to the population. We don't have that. We have very little leverage over candidates and elected officials because we have no credible threat to go elsewhere. The only options we've got are to vote for something probably that we don't like, hold our nose, because there's a greater threat, not vote at all, which is what the majority of people do, or vote for a third party, which really has little viability. And dominant party candidates know that. And so they're more inclined to keep the system as it is, even if it brings voter turnout down, because they would rather risk having a minority share of power in the current system than risk even less power in a more democratic system.
Wow. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Patrick Barrett about his recent article for Truthout, Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign. Now, there are a lot of Bernie supporters who are urging him to run as a third-party candidate with a kind of tremendous swell of support that he has. Do you think that this time might be different? That's to say, even if he would agree, which he's made no indication so far of doing. But is there any scenario under which a third party could gain power?
Well, okay, so here are the two. This is sort of a complicated thing. I think that, first of all, it's fair to say that third parties historically have played a significant role in the United States, even with the tremendous institutional barriers that they confront and the difficulty to remain viable or even, you know, exist beyond a short period of time. So historically, many of the most progressive policies, including like Social Security, have been ones that have been proposed by third parties first. So they've played that role that's not insignificant historically, but still have faced huge obstacles. And the obstacles are so significant that, as I wrote in the article, under the current rules of the game, let's imagine a third party that successfully displaces the Democrats from the current system, so that it's a reconstituted two-party system, but with a party replacing the Democrats. Even if they start out to the left of the Democrats, the likelihood is that they would morph or evolve into something resembling the Democrats today, because it's not so much about who's running the party or the rules internally about how they govern their party, but the systemic constraints, the rewards and punishments that they have to respond to. Most importantly, again, a system in which there's no alternative to the left that will hold that party accountable and create the kind of competitive pressure, and especially, again, in a social context where the balance of forces is so greatly weighted in favor of big business at the expense of everyone else, such that the gravitational pull is to the right. So it's not really so much about good guys and bad guys, that Democrats are all bad people, but rather they exist in an institutional and social context in which all the pressure goes in one direction, and people end up compromising. We all compromise in our daily lives, right? So what we need to do instead is really set our sights on radically democratizing this system, which includes building the institutional rules of the game that would make a multi-party system viable, that would eliminate these sorts of pressures of avoiding the spoiler effect or avoiding the wasted vote phenomenon. So the role that a third party could play, if done right, is to create the kind of, for lack of a better way of putting it, institutional crisis that makes it clear that the demand we have is that we will sort of muck up the system. We will cause enough disruption until and unless there are reforms to the system such that it becomes a multi-party system becomes viable. Because in the long run, under the current rules of the game, a third party can't prevail. And even if it did, as I said, and replaced the Democrats, it would be subject to the same kinds of constraints and pressures the Democrats are. We want to create a system in which good guys can be good guys and bad guys are forced to do the right thing.
What would be some of those reforms?
Well, some of these are huge. I mean, they're difficult. The question is whether or not there are stepping stones toward them. But one of the as I point out in the article, at the legislative level, whether it's United States Congress or House of Representatives or most state houses across the United States, state legislatures, we have really a de facto single or one-party system at the district level. So, in fact, there's huge numbers of uncontested elections. In Wisconsin, for example, in 2014, 47 out of 99 state assembly districts only had one candidate on the ballot. And this is not only due to gerrymandering and all the money, but very importantly, single-member districts where the election is winner-take-all. Instead, what we need is multi-member districts where with proportional representation, so that even if you get only 20% of the vote, you get roughly 20% of representation in the legislature. Mm-hmm. We need to move in that direction. So for legislative races, we need proportional representation. For executive offices, I think the improvement would be to move in the direction of what's known as instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting, in which you can select more than one candidate. You just rank them. And if the one you most want doesn't meet a certain threshold, your votes go to your second choice so that you can simultaneously vote for what you most want and sort of cover your butt by having a backup plan. These sorts of things are done all over the world, and most people, their attitude about the American electoral and political system is, well, it's just a given. It's part of the natural order of things. It's sort of like the weather. You can't change it. And in fact, this is a puzzling attitude because we rail against some of the most deep-seated structural historical problems, whether racism or sexism or capitalism. But when it comes to sort of the institutions of our government, we throw our hands up and say, well, it's just the way it is. Oh, we can't change that. When in fact, the right and big business and its allies are constantly monkeying with the system to make it less democratic. They're demonstrating to us that the system can change for the worse. So we need to get more ambitious about understanding, diagnosing the nature of our political system, how that poses an obstacle, and then start working on figuring out how we're going to reform it and democratize it. I mean, ultimately, this is a radical proposal, but it's, you know, when you confront an obstacle, you figure out how to get rid of it. We should abolish the Senate. We should abolish the Electoral College. There's a whole series of different institutional mechanisms which, in their design, were created to block change. I mean, the Senate is the most undemocratic or one of the most undemocratic legislative bodies in the world. And it's a legacy of slavery. It was designed to protect the interests of slave states so that their interests wouldn't be threatened by the adoption of democratic institutions. You know, we've reformed it to some degree. It used to be until a century ago that you couldn't even directly elect a senator. But today, it's an oligarchic body that represents only the upper tier of people. And so we've got all these institutional problems. And until we start seriously thinking about how we're going to democratize them, we're going to continue to run into roadblocks through our political system and our electoral system. This is a tall order, but just because it's difficult doesn't make it any less necessary.
So the Electoral College, explain that. Why is it so undemocratic?
It's undemocratic in much the same way that the Senate is undemocratic, in that instead of there being the possibility of just counting everybody's vote. So with the Electoral College, instead of just counting the raw number of votes for one candidate or another, we assign essentially delegates for each state. That there's a winner-take-all in almost every state for that state's delegates, such that, you know, you could win by a narrow margin in a big state where the losing, so-called losing candidate gets millions upon millions of votes and still gets zero recognition for that. So that there are scenarios then in which, as occurred in 2000, where one candidate, Al Gore, wins the popular vote, but another candidate wins the Electoral College vote. That's absurd. It's anachronistic and anti-democratic, and it should be eliminated. And there's been long been calls for doing precisely that. In the case of the Senate, by giving every state equal representation, you essentially disenfranchise the great majority of people. It's grossly inequitable representation, such that I think it's 11 states concentrate most of the population, and they get only, therefore, 11% of the representation, and the other states end up with far greater representation. And it's racially discriminatory because most people of color are concentrated in these states that have big populations. And just like the Senate has this rule of where only one-third of the Senate is available to be elected for every 2 years, it's aimed at blocking any kind of quick change. It's also now, of course, you need a supermajority to pass anything through the Senate. Again, this system is precisely designed to block change. And it's very difficult to use a system that is designed to block change as an instrument of change, unless you change the system itself.
Patrick Barrett. We'll talk more about the American election system and how to change it after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about our undemocratic election system and how to change it. Our guest is political scientist Patrick Barrett. Before the break, Barrett said it was very difficult to use the political system to make itself more democratic. That's one of the strategic lessons he draws from Bernie Sanders' anti-establishment campaign. The only way, he says, is to change the system itself. So, I mean, how do you do that? Because the people who benefit from this system, the politicians who benefit it, are going to fight like heck not to change the rules, and they're the ones who have to do it.
Well, I think that what we do is we take lessons from history and figure out how these things have changed before. Mm-hmm. So, typically, I mean, just to speak in the most general terms, change occurs when people make enough of a ruckus and disrupt business as usual enough such that the costs of ignoring the demands for change are greater than the costs of giving in to them. And so, you know, we apply the same sorts of lessons that we understand, say, from a labor union, that its greatest tool is to disrupt business as usual by going on strike. It imposes a cost on a business by saying either you give in to our demands or we're going to impose a cost on you in the form of lost business, and with the calculation that they'll eventually give in. Now, that calculation could be right or wrong in different circumstances. It often is right or often wrong. But the point is that's the strategy. And that's true of a boycott. That's true of people blocking intersections and engaging in civil disobedience. The idea is to disrupt and do so in a manner that people in power calculate that they can't ignore it. So it helps to explain why one of the most progressive administrations in the 20th century in terms of the policies it implemented was the Nixon administration. Huge expansion of social spending, for example. Landmark environmental legislation. These things were not done because Nixon was a good guy, in my opinion. It was because the balance of forces in the country were such, with the presence of very strong social movements, that his administration put their finger to the wind and understood that they had no choice but to go along with this to some degree. Of course, all administrations try to moderate that, try to give as little as possible, and that's true across the political spectrum. But we need to be more disruptive. We need militant social movements. We need to start creating the kinds of pressure that maybe begins to approximate the kind of political revolution that Bernie Sanders is calling for in the most general and vague terms. He hasn't been specific about, okay, let's take these 30,000 people that are gathering in New York for a rally and actually take them to the Verizon strike, right?
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of conflicts all over the country, in every neighborhood, in every city. And we have plenty of examples of how, you know, when people do that, just in Wisconsin recently, there was a day when Latinos skipped out on work for a day. They went on basically a general strike. And in the one example, just for one day, the dairy industry in Wisconsin depends heavily on Latino and undocumented Latino labor. And they went in a panic to the leaders of this movement and said, what can we do? We need our workers back. Don't take our workers away from us. These are the sorts of things that people respond to. And historically, political systems are more or less democratic, not because they're, you know, handed down from above, but because they're trying to respond to pressure from below.
Well, here's my fear. And by the way, I do remember the Nixon years. In fact, I was working as part of that labor and environmental coalition that helped to pass the EPA and the OSHA Act. But here's my fear, which is that with the kind of surveillance technology, with the ability to, I mean, control the internet, just yesterday, the very organization Election Justice USA that is trying to get New York to audit the vote and the affidavit ballots, their Facebook page was taken down. And I fear that no matter who gets in, but maybe even especially Hillary Clinton, that the mechanisms of control, of suppression, matched with, unparalleled strength in the police state, are going to create a situation where those mass movements are going to be very difficult to do. So I wonder if you could address that. I mean, they do happen, even in, you know, there was the Arab Spring, but look what happened to the Arab Spring.
Right. That's a totally legitimate fear, and that's hardly new, is it? I mean, it may be worse. I mean, or let's put it this way, that the capacity of the government is far greater technologically than it's ever been before. There is, in fact, a very... I mean, if any element of the state apparatus is super developed, it's the surveillance state. And that's unprecedented in terms of its capacity. But the intent of the government is hardly new. I mean, that was true. You know, there's been red scares in the early part of the 20th century, and then during the 50s, there's been repression, especially of not just labor, but of civil rights activists throughout the 20th century, including basically state-sanctioned murder, as well as surveillance. There's COINTELPRO. We know all about these things, right? So those have been long-standing fears, and I think that as part of our effort to build a more democratic set of institutions, and that's both in the formal political arena, but within the media, such as your very project represents, but also in educational institutions and in workplaces, you name it. We need to build democratic institutions, and we will confront people whose power and whose wealth and privilege will come under assault or be put at risk, and they will fight very hard to prevent that. So it's a question of either we draw a line in the sand and we start fighting these things and getting really clever and astute about how we're going to move forward in the most effective way, or we're going to see that situation only get worse. And I think that we have very good reason always to remain idealistic and aspirational. Human beings have accomplished tremendous progress in many, many, many ways historically, and we often lose sight of that. You know, anything human beings build, human beings can change. Mm. And it's important, I think, to simultaneously not be cynical, but also not be naive. In other words, let's maintain our aspirations and our goals for a just and democratic society, but let's not be naive about what it's going to take to make that happen. Let's understand what the landscape is, the lay of the land, and the kinds of obstacles that we confront, including what you've just mentioned, and how best to circumvent them, how best to overcome them, or how best to eliminate those obstacles. We can't just be sort of like willfully ignorant of those things and just fly off a cliff because we didn't realize there was a bridge we could have walked over or built.
And the stakes are so high.
And getting higher.
Exactly. I mean, climate change, the destruction of the natural environment. I mean, this is a make or break time for the human race.
Absolutely. So we need to make haste urgently, but also in the right way so that we don't set ourselves back. I mean, one of the dangers often with channeling people into the electoral process or into our political system, which again is designed to frustrate us, is that if we do so in a way that's sort of like, again, naive, I suppose, but just ignoring the kinds of problems that it presents, we run the risk of setting people up for disappointment, setting people up for being disillusioned. And that is a killer. One of our greatest obstacles, speaking of, you know, the movement or the left or whatever you want to call it, is a psychological one. There's a historian, Lawrence Goodwin, who wrote a famous book about the populist movement of the late 19th century. And he concluded it by saying that the progressive movement in the United States suffers from a syndrome, which he called sophisticated despair. The idea that American society could possibly marginally be humanized, but it cannot fundamentally be democratized. So oftentimes I think that we have this view that change isn't possible. You know, it even enters into our daily discourse. You can't fight City Hall, that kind of thing. And that's a killer to aspirations. And when those moments occur when we can get people rallied and mobilized and we send them off into, say, on an errand that has a high risk and low reward, we run the risk of deepening that kind of cynicism. So we need victories. And those victories have to be, I think, as much as possible, at least, on the basis of a good strategy that has a clear understanding of the, you know, in basic organizing, there's this notion of SWOT, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Yeah. You try to do a power mapping and understand the lay of the land so that know where your strengths are, know where your weaknesses are, know where your opportunities are, know where your threats are. Because that's good organizing. You figure out the lay of the land. You need to build successes and victories because on the basis of those, you inspire people to do more, but you also change the balance of power. You democratize the spaces in which you work. And we need to be smart about that. So I'm always convinced that change is possible. It's happening every day. You know, today's different than yesterday. Tomorrow will be different than today. But let's not give up, but at the same time, let's be, you know, strategically and analytically smart.
That's great. And, you know, with all the limitations of the Bernie Sanders campaign, I think that's something he has done. He has said over and over again that change is possible once people get organized.
Right. But again, not to pick on him, his campaign represents both opportunities and risks. And that general statement is absolutely true. And I think that as we started out this conversation, recognizing is that he's shifted the political landscape. But I really believe, as I wrote in the article, that we need to derive the right kinds of lessons about how change happens. His aspirational goals, I think, are beautiful. I think that he's been less ambitious about how we can achieve them. Mm-hmm. He's been less specific or even said much about being really ambitious about democratizing this political system other than removing money from it, which is indisputably necessary. But there's so much more we need to do that he hasn't spoken to. So I think that we can learn from this. We can learn from not only the seeing the mobilization and the energizing of all these, especially young people, but also, all right, what obstacles did we run into? What lessons can we learn from that? And how are we going to devise better strategies now that we've figured this out?
Well, your article is terrific. It's Can We Change the Political System? Strategic Lessons of the Bernie Sanders Campaign. Patrick Barrett, thank you so much for talking with us. That article is on Truthout. There will be a link to that on the Writer's Voice website. There is a link to it on the Writer's Voice website. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thanks very much for having me and for having conversations like this.
Patrick Barrett is director of the A.E. Haven Center for Social Justice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He writes and teaches about U.S. and Latin American politics and is the co-editor of The New Latin American Left. Next, we re-air an edited version of our 2008 interview with Greg Palast about the book he co-authored, Steal Back Your Vote. Investigative reporter Greg Palast has been writing about the disenfranchisement of voters since the 2000 presidential election. In 2004, he reported on how thousands of votes for John Kerry were thrown away as spoiled. Then, in 2008, he paired up with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to write a graphic book called Steal Back Your Vote. He also wrote the 2012 book Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, illustrated by cartoonist Ted Rall. Unfortunately, the situation has only gotten worse since that time, especially with the purging of voters from the rolls, as in Arizona, New York, Pennsylvania, and other states. It seemed like this would be a good time to take a listen back to that 2008 interview. Now, you've been reporting on the disenfranchisement of voters since the election of 2000, and then it was about stopping the count in the presidential election. How has the situation changed since then?
It hasn't. It's gotten worse. And for those who don't know me, I'm the reporter that broke the story about how Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush knocked off tens of thousands of black voters off the voter rolls, calling them felons, and their only crime was voting while black. Well, unfortunately, the whole nation's been fluoridated under something called the Help America Vote Act, which George Bush signed. And you know what happens when Bush tells us he's going to help us vote. So we got a bit of a problem here. So what's happened is what Harris did in Florida, what Catherine Harris did in Florida, was to wipe out voter rolls by purging voters because there was something wrong with, in that case, they were supposedly felons. Well, that's now happening around the country under the authority of the Help America Vote Act. I just came back from Colorado, where they have purged 1 in 5 voters on the voter rolls. 1 in 5, calling them either felons or dead, inactive, whatever. I mean, in some cases, a lot of cases it's legit. But I got to tell you, for example, that in Colorado, ex-felons can vote. So what are they doing getting purged? Many of them are getting purged by the tens of thousands with no time to recover before the elections to even complain about it.
Today in the New York Times, as we speak today, there was an article, there was an article yesterday about the same kind of thing that you're talking about, the disenfranchisement of voters, throwing them off the rolls, doing this illegally. Today, Colorado came back and said that they were actually going to reinstate many of those voters on the rolls.
That's a lie. First of all, they lie. They purge people illegally before the 2004 election. The Republican Secretary of State has stolen that state blind, two of them. And if you read, in fact, you can get, by the way, our comic book at stealbackyourvote.org, where you can download it. We have a section, Section 3, which is called The Purge in General, and it's about Danetta Davidson, Secretary of State of Colorado, who began this massive purge of 1 in 5 voters. Their actions are totally illegal. Their actions are certainly immoral. They're taking away the vote from people who supposedly stop fraud, but there's not a single case of fraud we know of in Colorado, not a single case. So then George Bush took Danetta Davidson, who purged all these people and made her chairwoman of the United States Elections Assistance Commission, where her job is to show everyone how to purge the voter rolls.
Now, this is not an equal opportunity robbery here. You're saying that certain voters are getting more disenfranchised than others.
Our experience, our measurements are that it's always the poor, always the vulnerable, always minorities who are getting the disproportionate whack, just like with the felon purges. That's how it works, the fake felon purges. And the truth is when you knock out black voters, Hispanic voters, and one of the biggest groups hit hard are Native American voters. Those are solid Democratic groups, 2-to-1 Hispanic, 88% of blacks vote Democratic, and about 90-some percent of Native Americans vote Democratic.
So purges are one way, purging the voter rolls illegally. Yeah. You talk about 6 ways that the vote is being stolen. One of them is to make registering voters a crime.
That's right. In the comic book, in Steal Back Your Vote, we say that we have 6 ways that they're stealing the election. And then, very important, let's not forget, we give you 7 ways to steal it back. So that let's not despair here. There's actions you can take. But the first one is we're talking about they've blockaded registrations. They virtually criminalized registering voters. They made it so bad that the League of Women Voters has pretty much stopped voter registration drives. You make a clerical error, you pass in something late, you get hit for thousands of dollars on each form. It's crazy. So who wants to do this?
And spoiling the vote. You say that not everyone's vote spoils the same, as you've talked about. Talk about how are votes actually spoiled?
Well, that's simple. Your chads get hung, or your punches don't punch, your touch screen doesn't feel touched properly, and the result is that your vote simply gets lost. And by the way, the best way to lose your vote is to mail it in. So that's called a spoiled vote or an undervote. In other words, the vote just didn't show up. And here's the ugly little fact. If you're African-American, the chance your vote will spoil, that you'll cast it and it won't get counted for some technical reason, is 900% higher than if you're a white voter.
Could you give us an example of a spoil vote?
Well, for example, in New Mexico, in the last election, 2004, in one of the counties, one precinct showed not a single vote for president in the machines. This was the overseas precinct, which is almost all Hispanic soldiers sent overseas. Are you saying that Hispanic soldiers send in their ballots, not one of them is chosen a commander-in-chief? Or are we getting shafted by the machines? Now, this is, by the way, very different from the usual fear of hacking machines where you worry that they'll change one vote into another. That's really sophisticated stuff. May or may not happen. That's not the point. The point that we have is that these machines simply don't register your vote. That has no fingerprints. Unlike changing the software, unplugging the machine is the number one way that electronic votes are lost.
Wow.
Destroying the machine is one way the votes are lost. Dropping the machine, breaking the machine, losing the password is the main way that the votes are lost. And they are lost in Hispanic districts. They're lost in poor districts. And then things like punch cards, where you're still back to the old chads. You know, this is the problem. I mean, paper ballots, if you don't have an in-precinct scanner, the chances that they're not, you make a stray mark on a paper ballot, and that's destroyed. People say, oh, thank God we've got paper ballots. Well, hey, man, you make an extra mark on a paper ballot, you lose that vote unless you've got a special in-precinct reader that allows you a chance to correct your ballot. So that's what's happening. I mean, they're stealing it blind. So we're telling you, this is very important. You have to protect yourself. I'm not here on the program with you to whine. I'm here to talk about protection. You know, there's things you can do. There's 7 steps. But you got to go to stealbackyourvote.org and get it.
But I want to go back to some of these, because, again, today I was listening to National Public Radio, and they said on there, they were talking about the problems with the votes and talking about it mostly that it was kind of accidental, and said that, well, if you really have a problem and there's an issue, you can always cast a provisional vote.
They don't count provisional ballots. They throw them in the garbage, okay? If you have a reason why, if some pimply GOP jerk has your name on a purge list and challenges your vote, and they say, oh, well, just fill out this provisional ballot, we'll see if you're a legal voter. They don't.
And
forget the little old lady behind the desk. She's lying because she doesn't know. She's trying to get you out the door so the line keeps moving. So she gives you a placebo ballot so you can pretend to vote. But I got to give you another bit of advice is we do tell you, you really have to vote early.
How effective do you feel are the 7 prescriptions you give to the 6 ways in which they try to steal your vote? Do you think we're actually going to be able to pull off, if people do the things that you suggest they do in your comic book, Steal Back Your Vote, how effective do you think they're going to be?
Well, it's like a condom. It's not 100% protection, but it's, you know, you don't want to do without it. And so here's the thing. The 7 steps to steal back your vote are the best 7 steps you can take to protect yourself. It's not going to be 100%, but Bobby and I are hoping we can literally save 500,000 votes nationwide. We think we can do that. And that's an awful lot in swing states, because you can only steal a state that's in swing. And for example, Al Gore won New Mexico. You thought Florida was close. Al Gore won New Mexico by 366 votes. Then Bush won it in 2004, supposedly by 5,000 votes, all disputed ballots. So don't put your ballot in dispute. And by the way, there's another thing to keep in mind. There's more than the presidential race. California has one of the worst records in terms of local officials stealing a vote. They say, well, why? Everyone knows that Obama's going to walk away with California. Because there's more than one race on the ballot. So please protect your vote. I don't care what state you're in. If you're in New York State, you better be careful. Because there's always someone out to snatch your vote. And sometimes it really is accidental or benign, or you're just caught in the system. Your name is not there for some cockamamie reason on the voter registries with these new laws. You've been purged. So do you still want to throw away your vote? See, voting procedure is not what it used to be. We didn't have provisional ballots and purge lists and early voting and all this stuff before. It's brand new. So you have to kind of relearn how to vote. It's no longer showing up on election day and picking a candidate. And you know what? Even though people say, oh, yeah, the poor Mexicano voters don't know how to vote. You know what? We did a survey, Bobby and I, of lawyers, of elections lawyers who didn't know the laws.
Wow.
Because it's so complicated. So that's why we've boiled it down to 7 easy steps. Like, for example, bring photo ID with your name on it that matches your registration exactly. You know why I want to do that? Because, and then I'm told, oh, well, but you don't need that in Ohio if you've been registered 4 years. The rules are so complicated that you better come in protected, okay? Mm-hmm. And also, it doesn't matter what your rules are in your state. The person that sets the rules, the judge of whether you can vote, is that little old lady behind the table. And if she's decided you need an ID, you can show her all kinds of laws. We've had people arrested trying to vote who didn't have the right ID. Arrested! And all they were doing is following laws saying, I don't need an ID and I demand a ballot, and they get busted.
Greg Palast, in a 2008 interview about his book, Steal This Vote, he also wrote the 2012 book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, illustrated by Ted Rall. By the way, I spoke to Palast recently for an article he wrote about the New York primary voter purges. Find links to the book and the recent article at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.